From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later in today's program, you'll hear from listeners responding to some recent topics and guests in our show, including the so-called wilderness area called Woodbridge near Lodi, also the Wild Horse Roundup in Lassen County, and that cell biologist, Bruce Lipton, who was on our show on Friday. Also today, David Kolchek, the Sacramento author, who is featured on a TV show, the Investigation Discovery Channel this Thursday, telling his story of the Duchess, who was the first woman executed in California's gas chamber. And you'll meet the Sacramento chef, who is a finalist in the next Food Network Star YouTube challenge. But first, getting kids back to school for the first day of class can be a logistical challenge, but it was probably a little easier today for some families in Elk Grove. That's because today was the first day of classes at the Elk Grove Unified School District's virtual academy. That's where instruction happens online. The instruction is run by a company called K-12. We'll talk with the CEO of that company in a moment, but we start with Ann Zeman of Elk Grove Unified School District. She's Director of Curriculum and Professional Learning and co-director of the district's new virtual academy. Anne, welcome to Insight.
Good morning, Jeffrey.
Why did Elk Grove schools decide that they wanted an online or virtual academy?
Well, we have been noticing over a couple of years that our parents are signaling us that they would like alternatives, they would like choices. And so we thought this was a good time for us to expand our the variety of choices that we can offer parents.
When you say parents have been signaling that they want choices, what kind of choices beyond what they already have? Because homeschooling is already an option.
Yes, you're right. Homeschooling is an option. Some people would like homeschooling within the school district rather than leaving the school district. Some people start out when their children are very, very young homeschooling and then would like a little more interaction and support from the school district. And others have signaled us by asking questions. Are you going to offer any of these classes online? Those types of things.
How many students have enrolled in the virtual academy?
We're very pleased. We have quite a few, and the number is actually growing, even though today is the first day of school. We are well over 100 and still getting students registered.
Up to what point will you be enrolling students?
That has not yet been determined. Right now, we're looking at the end of the month or possibly extending for a second term at a later date.
So, in other words, students could be taking quote-unquote regular classes and transfer into the virtual academy.
We don't expect that that's the case. This California state laws do not allow students to simultaneously attend two schools. So this is not a program for students who are attending a school during the day and then want to pick up another course or two.
In other words, they can't do it, or it's just not meant for them?
They can't do it attendance-wise. That the state does not allow us to accept students on that basis. They're either full-time in our virtual academy or full-time in our regular brick-and-mortar school.
Okay. And you said you got about 100 students enrolled.
Over that, yes.
Over that. What's the target, if there is one?
We haven't set a target. We have been thrilled and actually somewhat surprised by the degree of interest early on. And so we're watching that actually daily. And within a couple of weeks, we'll be determining when we need to cut off registration so that we can best serve students.
We're talking about the new virtual academy in Elk Grove. It's a public school virtual academy. Ann Zeman is with the district. The courses are run by K-12, which is a private company. And the founder and CEO, Ron Packard, joins us. Ron, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, what exactly does K-12 do? What do you offer?
Well, K-12 was designed to build the best online curriculum and technology to deliver classes online to children in grades K through 12. I started the company about 10 years ago, and since then we've invested about $170 million building these courses, and they're now being used by over 70,000 full-time students across the United States. And the idea is really to create an online experience and courses that, you know, are as good or even better sometimes than what you can get in the classroom, and really give kids a great online experience where they learn a great deal.
Well, you said an online experience. Can you tell us a bit more about what that means? How is that different from, and how might it be better, in your opinion, than sitting in an actual classroom with an actual teacher?
Well, what it can do is, it's always great to be in a classroom, and good schools do a great job. What you can do sometimes in online experiences is bring in a rich world of media. For example, we might bring in chemistry, chemical reaction simulators that show you how the molecular action is happening in a chemical reaction, or show interesting pieces of flash animation that might explain how quadratic equations work. So, you know, what you want to do is create a rich experience. It's not just putting a textbook online. What you want to be able to do is offer a rich array of media that brings the experience to life. And even in online education, it's very important that these children all have teachers, and the teacher is central to the learning process. So, you know, it's kind of one of the myths out there that somehow in online learning you don't have teachers. It's the opposite. We find that the most important factor in what delivers a great result is a great teacher. So what you want to do in an online experience is combine a great teacher with great online curricula and bring in a rich array of media. And if you do these things right and have a well-trained teacher and an effective teacher, you can get a great learning experience online.
How do you create your curriculum? Every state has its own curriculum standards and so on.
What we basically did was looked at the most rigorous standards across the 50 states and built a curriculum that would meet all of those. And that way, when you go into each individual state, we're tailoring it for that state's individual standards. But rarely do we have to build anything new. The only exception to that is in local state history, where we build that when we actually get a client in that state. But essentially, we built kind of a superset of curriculum, and it's designed to be, you know, very rigorous. So we haven't had many issues having to build new things. In fact, some of the standards I think originally we built off of were California standards, which are quite good in math and science particularly.
Ann Zeman at Elk Grove Unified, how was the curriculum that you were presented with from K-12, the standard curriculum? Did you think it needed changes?
Well, let me start by saying one of the reasons that we elected to go with K-12 was because not only of their track record of success, but because of the high quality of their curricular, their courseware. I would clarify that we have tried to retain control over the instructional pieces by hiring our own teachers. And in some cases, we are building what we call curricular bridges. And I have to acknowledge that it's relatively minor and relatively few in number, but there are some cases in which our district standards do not, which are aligned to state standards, but we have our own district standards that don't perfectly align with K-12. And in those cases, our teachers build bridges.
Ron Packard, how does K-12 make money? How much do you bill a district like Elk Grove?
I mean, how much we bill individually. The way K-12 make money is, you know, we sell the courses for a per-student fee, and we also sometimes sell technology and, in some cases, teaching services. So across the country, K-12 makes its money by selling those various services to districts and to other schools who want to use them. So it's usually on a per-child basis, and it's on a per-course basis. So it would vary depending on how many kids and what courses there were. If there were zero, it would be nothing. But, it's a variable fee that goes up, you know, proportional with the number of students. So for district partners like Elk Grove, you know, they only pay for what they use.
But in California, at least, and no doubt in other states, school districts are compensated, if that's the right word to use, by the state for every student that's enrolled in a given school. Is your fee based on that?
Yes, our fee would be based on the number of enrollments they have in the virtual school. So, you know, they get so much from the state for those enrollments, and part of that money would go to pay K-12 for the curriculum and any other services we provide.
And is there money above the fee that's paid to K-12 that comes back to Elk Grove or stays with Elk Grove?
In order to run our virtual academy, we are able to stay to hire our own teachers and pay K-12 for their courseware and their platform, and still remain within the funding that we receive from the state.
Ron Packard, I've heard of critics of K-12 in this kind of model who don't like private companies making a profit through money that ultimately comes from taxpayers. How do you respond to that criticism?
You know, I think, you know, people should look at it a little different way. They should look at, are you getting value for the services provided? It shouldn't matter who provides it, in the sense of what we care about at K-12 is what's great for kids. And I think that's what districts care about. And we're able to invest a lot of money building very high-quality curriculum that really no district could ever invest that amount of money. And therefore, we then turn and sell that to districts. So it becomes, there are certain things the private sector does very well, and particularly when you get into large amounts of investment, content creation, technology. You know, private sector is generally more efficient that way, so we take advantage of that, and it allows school districts like Elk Grove to take advantage of the efficiencies of capital in the private market to deliver a better experience for kids. And we're now able to deliver that over, you know, as I said, more than 70,000 kids. So, you know, I think people should focus on what's best for children, and whether it's a district providing it, a for-profit, not-for-profit, it really shouldn't matter. What should matter is, does it work for kids? And I think K-12 is now, you know, proven that what we do works very well for children, and we continue to invest enormous amount of money to make the curriculum and technology better every single year, and hopefully spread that over more and more children as we get more successful. So, you know, in my book, it shouldn't matter who's providing it. Is it great? Does it work for kids? And that's what this country and school districts should be concerned about. That's what I'm concerned about.
Ron Packard of K-12, a private for-profit company that offers online instruction for grades K through 12, an online academy with instructional materials from K-12, started today with the Elk Grove Unified School District, and Ann Zeman is with the district. Ann, since none of the students at the virtual academy are coming from your regular classrooms, that means they're coming from the students who are not currently enrolled in Elk Grove schools. Does that mean there's a financial incentive here for Elk Grove to make more money, basically?
Well, let me clarify a few points there, if I may, Jeffrey.
Of course.
What we find is that there is a percentage, 20 to 25% of the students who have enrolled in our virtual academy have formerly been Elk Grove Unified students. And they are opting for the virtual academy instead of opting for a homeschool or another situation that they may have been considering. About 75%, however, so far are coming either from within our own attendance boundaries, but they have formerly been homeschooled or attended a private school, or they may be from outside of our district boundaries. And so our primary mission was to look for a way to better serve the needs of some of our families. Now, I would not assert to you, because I don't believe it for a minute, that eventually all students are going to be educated this way. I don't believe that. I believe that the majority of our students do very well in brick-and-mortar schools and are happy to remain in brick-and-mortar schools. We're simply looking for alternatives and to have a presence in the market.
But still, doesn't this ultimately increase the amount of money you get from the state of California, because you will have more students participating?
It has that potential.
Yes. What role do current Elk Grove School District teachers play in this? Are they involved in the instruction of these kids in the virtual academy?
Huge role, critical role. I think sometimes in casual conversation, we mix up curriculum and instruction. And the instruction is what comes from the teacher, how the teacher assists the student with his or her learning. I would like to use an analogy that other people have found effective. If we need to hire a teacher to teach calculus, we don't first ask that individual to write the calculus book. Similarly, we're asking our teachers to use this new method of imparting instruction, but they're using courseware that we've hired through K-12, through a vendor, just as formerly we would purchase textbooks from a vendor. It's a similar analogy, I find.
Ron Packard, the co-founder with you of the company about 10 years ago was the well-known conservative William Bennett, who was, among other things, education secretary under President Reagan. Did William Bennett exert any influence on the educational philosophy of K-12 that we can see today?
No, I don't think he did. I think what Bill was very helpful in getting top quality educators to work with K-12. You know, being a former Secretary of Education, he brought a lot of credibility to the company in its early days. Most of our curriculum was created by, you know, people we hired. The original founder was, the first person was the Core Knowledge Foundation, which had influence on the original curriculum. But really the primary influence was state standards, in the sense that we're looking to be able to meet the state standards of 50 different states. So most of what went into the curriculum was really determined by state standards.
Why is William Bennett no longer involved in the company?
You know, I think there's a natural transition, and in the early days, you know, Bill provided a great deal of credibility to the company and a great deal of value, and, you know, he moved on to other things. I believe he has his own radio show now, and, you know, K-12 has moved in a lot of different directions since then, so it was a very, you know, a mutual parting, I should say, and, you know, Bill's doing great, and K-12 is doing great.
Just one other thing about William Bennett. He's an advocate for homeschooling, but I've read several websites written by people who are homeschooling, parts of homeschooling families, and they've expressed concerns about K-12. How would you address the homeschooling, the concerns among homeschooling families about what K-12 would do for their families? Because, of course, you're working in cases like with Elk Grove with public school districts.
Well, I think homeschooling is very different than public virtual schooling, and it's important to understand that. When you homeschool, you can choose whatever curriculum you like. You don't have certified teachers, and you don't have to take state tests. So when people enroll in these public virtual schools, their education is under the guidance of a certified teacher, and the curriculum they're using meets the state standard. So a lot of homeschoolers don't necessarily want that kind of, you know, intervention into their curricula or their teaching, and they want to just do it themselves. But I'd also add that a lot of homeschoolers love the public virtual schools, and many have come into the public virtual schools across the country and are loving it and getting a great education. It's just for certain, you know, homeschoolers, they don't want to have to conform with state standards.
Your own professional and educational background appears to be in economics, management consulting. You worked for Goldman Sachs. How did you get into this business?
I mean, I started getting very interested in education probably about 13 years ago, where I started, you know, I ran a large daycare company called Knowledge Learning Corporation, and just really believed that, you know, when I saw the internet coming, I really believed this technology could be used to help children all over the world, so you would no longer matter where you lived. If you had access to the internet, you could get a great education. My background was in technology and really management and economics, and K-12 started really as a technology curriculum company. Now we're much more than that, but, you know, my passion for children is what really drove me into this, and I feel very lucky that I get to wake up every day, and my purpose is to help children get a better education.
And Ann Zeman, last question for you. What if a child doesn't have a computer or a fast internet connection at home? Does Elk Grove help in any way? Does K-12 help?
K-12 has partnered with us, and they are actually providing computers for families who indicate that they need one to help their program work.
Okay, well, Ann Zeman is with Elk Grove Unified School District. She's Director of Curriculum and Professional Learning and co-director of the district's new virtual academy that opened today. And Ron Packard is founder and CEO of K-12, a private for-profit company that offers, that provides the instruction for the children who are attending the virtual academy in similar schools, both public and private across the country and in other countries. Ron Packard, Ann Zeman, thanks for joining us in Insight.
Thank you
for having us.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, listeners respond to recent guests and topics. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Follow me on Twitter. I send out info about upcoming shows and more. Later this morning on Talk of the Nation, an average of 9 people drown each day in the U.S., and it turns out a surprising number of Americans can't swim. That's one of several topics on Talk of the Nation. It starts at 11 this morning after Insight. Well, it's time to hear what our listeners think. With me is Insight's Jen Picard. Jen, welcome back.
Good morning.
Well, a little over a week ago, we talked about a so-called wilderness area near Lodi called Woodbridge. Residents say it's just a neglected park that's a fire risk and attracts troublemakers. San Joaquin County owns the property and is trying to figure out what to do with it. Recently, they brought in a crew to clear out brush. A listener called Joshua wrote to say the county hasn't spent much on Woodbridge in a long time.
The county spent nothing on the wilderness area for 10 years and then paid less than $20,000 to thin the vegetation. So they've spent $2,000 a year. Ongoing maintenance of the park involves shared resources with other parks. The main costs and complaints about the park are only a reflection of the gang crime problem of the Woodbridge community. These law enforcement issues should be addressed through a public campaign.
I wasn't aware there was a gang crime problem in Woodbridge, but if someone can give us more about that, you can let us know. On Thursday, we talked about the roundup of hundreds of wild horses in Lassen County. It's being done by contractors for the federal government. The feds say there are too many wild horses for the area to support. A listener called Heinz wrote to us from Europe with a question.
I live in Switzerland, where large quantities of horse steaks are on sale at supermarkets, which by law have to mention the provenance of the products. In this case, the countries of origin are USA/Canada. Could it be that some of the rounded up wild horses are ending up at slaughterhouses?
Well, the Bureau of Land Management says no. In fact, on their website, they call that a myth.
This charge is absolutely false. The BLM does not and has not sold or sent horses or burros to slaughter.
Heinz followed up with some research. He asked Swiss Customs for statistics about the horse meat that comes into Switzerland. The number one supplier by far is Canada. Mexico is also a big supplier. A relatively small amount of the horse meat came from the US, some 22,000 kilograms out of nearly 5 million total. We wondered about Heinz listening to us in Switzerland. He tells us he lived in San Francisco for 25 years and spent a lot of time in Tahoe, and that's how he started listening to Insight. Last Friday, our first guest startup reaction, Bruce Lipton, a cell biologist and author of The Biology of Belief. He says our thoughts and feelings can change our DNA. One listener, who gave just the initial R for his or her first name, was intrigued.
That was a really interesting interview with cell biologist Bruce Lipton. I really appreciated the evidence he brought to the table.
But a listener called Jan was unimpressed.
Hard to believe the cell biologist is a real scientist. He was very unscientific and thus not very credible. Screen those speakers, please.
Well, Bruce Lipton's style and arguments did rub some people the wrong way, but he is a scientist. He earned his PhD at the University of Virginia at Charlottesville. He taught at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine in Madison and was a scholar at Stanford University Medical Center. And Jan, I believe we heard again from Jan this morning.
Yes, she found his credentials to be quite credible.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. Other guests on Friday were Wendy Ray Hill and Carrie Tedrick, a couple who plan to get married when the stay on same-sex marriages is lifted. That's scheduled to happen this Wednesday afternoon, unless opponents of same-sex marriage get a new stay from a higher court. A listener called Leroy wrote to say his big fear about same-sex marriage is what could come next.
Will the same-sex agenda next target my church if we preach against same-sex marriage? Will that be a hate crime?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but I think there has to be an actual crime committed before something can be designated a hate crime. And last I heard, preaching in church isn't a crime. Finally, a listener called Noel emailed us on Tuesday with this question.
What happened to Jeffrey Callison?
I'm here. Seriously, though, as you might recall, Insight was on hiatus Monday through Wednesday last week. On Thursday, a listener called Alan wrote,
glad you are back on the air today. I was afraid your show had been canceled.
A lot of people wrote to say they liked the show that replaced Insight for those 3 days. Here's what Paul wrote.
I am immensely proud of Cap Radio for producing Insight. That said, I would just like to also say that Radiolab rocks. Please find a slot for Radiolab.
We like Radiolab too, but only a few episodes are made each year, so it's not possible to find a regular slot for it. Be assured, though, that Radiolab will return to our station. Actually, there will be another episode next Monday. The topic, believe it or not, is famous tumors. In other words, tumors that have changed the course of science. And in fact, there'll be another Radiolab on Tuesday, but I don't know what the topic is then. Finally, a listener called Cynthia wrote about something on Insight that bothers her.
Love your show, but hate the theme music.
Oh, really?
It sounds very dowdy and provincial. I'd expect it to precede a show on PBS hosted by a matronly woman having to do with dog grooming, scrapbooking, or tips for playing a better game of bridge. Can't you get another musical theme? You deserve better. We deserve better.
Funny you should say that, Cynthia. One of the many things we discussed during our hiatus was our theme song. We don't know whether we'll change it or rearrange it or leave it alone, but it is something we're thinking about. Tell us what you think about Insight, our topics, our guests, or even our theme song. You can email us at insight@capradio.org or visit us on Facebook, Insight at Capital Public Radio. Jen, thank you.
You're very welcome.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. When we come back, Sacramento author David Kolchak, he is appearing on TV this Thursday telling the story of the Duchess, which is a chapter from a book he wrote a while ago about bizarre crimes in California. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Did you disagree with anything on Insight? Tell us what and why at insight@capradio.org. Tomorrow in our program, local scientists invent a probe for early detection of oral cancer. It could also help a surgeon remove the tumor. And the problem of meningitis. It's a potentially fatal disease of special concern to children and teens. Those guests and more on Insight tomorrow morning. Sacramento author David Kolchak is going to be on TV this Thursday. He's going to be on the program Deadly Women, which airs on the Investigation Discovery Channel. He's going to be telling a story called The Duchess. It's a chapter from his book Death in California, The Bizarre, Freakish, and Just Curious Ways People Die in the Golden State. He joins us in our studio. David Kolchak, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here again.
Well, you joined us in Insight when the book came out. At that time, did you know that you were going to be a TV star because of it?
No, I had no idea. I'm not sure if I'm going to be a TV star anyways, but it's one of those head and shoulders deals, you know.
Tell us about how this happened. When did you hear that there was interest in one of the chapters in your book for this TV show?
It was about last January, and I got an email from this production company, Beyond Productions, from Australia, from Sydney, and they contacted me and said they wanted to do a chapter of my book.
This production company is from Australia, but they were interested in your book, Death in California. Do you know how they even heard about your book, let alone why they would be interested in making something about it?
I have no idea how they found my book. They just found it somehow, and they liked the chapter and wanted me to do the old head and shoulders trick on the show.
So the show is called Deadly Women. What's it about?
It's about women who kill, women criminals. And this is the third season on it for it. And it seems to be pretty popular. They do reenactments and scan the photos, and then they have the head and shoulders guy narrating it. And it's kind of funny because I saw some of the clips on their website, and it's in Australia, and so they have right-handed drive vehicles, but they're supposed to be in America.
Oh, of course. David Kolchak is author of Death in California. A chapter of the book titled The Duchess will be featured on an episode of Deadly Women on the Investigation Discovery Channel this Thursday. So it's a film crew from Australia, and where do they shoot you? I mean, I shouldn't say shoot in this context. With your book, you never know what that might mean, but videotaped you.
Actually, it was in my kitchen. My home office is too small to get a good angle with their cameras, and so the camera was by the washing machine in the other room and through the doorway, and they had a black background behind me and all the lights. And
so do you look very mysterious?
Let's just say I shaved my head really well that day.
And your head is shaved today very well. The Duchess, we're going to hear an excerpt from that, not an excerpt from how it's told on the TV show, but we have an in-house reader who's an expert on such matters. He's going to read a portion of the story. But David, could you first of all just talk us into this part of the story? Who was the Duchess? What was her name? When was she born? Where and so on, that kind of stuff.
Well, there's a lot of mysteries about where she was born. They say it was October 17th, 1889 in Kentucky, but she told so many lies that you cannot believe anything that she ever said. She used to say that she was born in a hobo jungle. And there's like so little known about her and she was just a pathological liar.
What about her name? What was her real name?
Her real name, they're not really sure, but it's Ethel Lita Juanita Spinelli, and Spinelli was her criminal husband's name who supposedly died running guns into Mexico.
Well, we're going to pick up the story of the Duchess as read here by Capital Public Radio's very own Jason Badal.
The Duchess rounded up a handful of malcontents with serious mental deficiencies. 18-year-old Robert Sherrod, 21-year-old car thief and jailbird Gordon Hawkins, and Albert Ives, a 24-year-old one-eyed halfwit. Together with a 32-year-old Simone, who acted as a case man as well as the Duchess's lover, the gang knocked off gas stations and rolled drunks. Spinelli's teenage daughter Lorraine was used as a sex lure by her criminally demented mother. Lorraine, whose street name was Gypsy, would approach drunken men with the promise of easy sex. Once they were alone, Spinelli's thugs would rob the man, sometimes taking his clothes. Juanita thought of herself as the brains of the outfit, and when she wasn't planning small-time robberies, she was cooking and cleaning for her troop of young crooks. Acting as the teacher, Spinelli instructed the boys in the fine arts of robbery, assault, and car theft. She taught them that it was smarter to commit a steady stream of small crimes than one big one like robbing a bank. She explained that the police would go all out to find a bank robber, but they would more than likely shrug at a man who woke up on the sidewalk with his wallet missing. Providing them with the mother figure that they had never had, Spinelli delegated jobs for the gang and doled out their cut of the money as if it were an allowance. On a foggy night on April 8, 1940, Ives shot barbecue stand owner Leland S. Cash while attempting to rob him of the day's receipts. The 55-year-old Cash was deaf and didn't hear Ives when he demanded the money. Cash reached into his pocket to turn up his hearing aid, but the dim-witted Ives blasted the restaurateur before he had a chance to comply, leaving him to die in the parking lot of his diner at Lincoln Way and La Playa in San Francisco's Sunset District. The Duchess panicked, packed up her gang, and headed for Sacramento in a stolen car, stopping only to rob a gas station on the way out of San Francisco. Settling at a cheap hotel on the seedy side of town, the gang drank whiskey and planned to make quick money by rolling drunks in Sacramento.
By rolling drunks in Sacramento. That's Jason Badal reading from The Duchess. It's a chapter from the book Death in California by Sacramento author David Kolchak, and he's featured on an episode of Deadly Women on the Investigation Discovery Channel telling the story of The Duchess. That happens this Thursday. What happens after that to The Duchess? She comes to Sacramento?
They come to Sacramento, and it's you know, this is the middle of the Depression. There aren't that many people to roll. And, of course, they were staying in Old Sac, which back then was where you'd go to score heroin.
Skid Row.
Yeah, it was Skid Row, you know. That's where you got heroin and transvestite hookers. So they decided that the Sherrod was talking too much. And, you know, he was just a kid, you know. He came from the Preston School of Industry over there. And he was saying, I wonder if the guy felt, you know, when we shot him, I wonder how he felt and all that. And they thought, we got to get rid of this guy. So they drove down to have a picnic down by the Freeport Bridge. And they wanted him to jump in the river and swim. And he didn't like to swim. And then, of course, it was April. And you can imagine, you know, how high the river was and how fast it was running. And back then, that's where the ships were coming up and down the river. It's full of tugboats and stuff. He wouldn't get in. So later that night, they slipped him a Mickey in his drink, and the plan was just to fold up his clothes, make it look like he went swimming off the Freeport Bridge, and drown. But instead, they all started beating him up, and they basically killed him by beating him up.
Wow.
Plus, he OD'd off the Mickey, and then they threw him in the river. And he got caught up in some pilings. They found him right away.
But the long arm of the law did catch up with the Duchess.
Oh, yeah. They decided to run to Reno because there was more money there and they had just killed somebody in Sacramento. And it didn't sound like a good thing to stay in town. So they start heading out in two different cars to Reno. And Ives kind of heard them talking about a 300-foot cliff or something. And he thought, why would they talk about that? And then he kind of saw them exchanging glances, and he thought, they're going to get rid of me next. He wasn't as dim-witted as they thought. And at least he had that kind of street smarts. And so in Nevada City, he ran out. They were at a gas station. He just ran into the woods, just abandoned the car. And he ran to the chip station and told them, and they were picked up in Truckee. And the Duchess tried to pull this, like, I'm just a mom with my kids, and the cops opened up her trunk, and there were, like, guns and all kinds of stolen merchandise in it. And Oh, they got her.
Goodness. Now, you told the story for this film crew for the program Deadly Women, but they didn't have enough. That did not provide enough David Kolchek for them because they're coming back for more.
Yeah, they're coming back for more in September. We're going to film another chapter that I'm going to keep under wraps for now, but we might have found some people that were involved in, not in the crime, they were the victims of the crime. And we're going to see how that pans out because it might be a bigger episode than we thought.
So it's a chapter that is in the book, but you just can't say which chapter because of this potentially dramatic element that could be added to it.
Yeah, and the person lives so close by, she might even be listening, and we haven't really contacted her yet.
I see. But in any case, the Australian film crew is going to return to film you in September for another episode of Deadly Women, but later this season?
Yeah, it'll be on later this season. I guess it's going to be on the season three, and I guess it's going to be at the end of season three. So,
and you're working on another book, also with an intriguing title, David Kolchek style. Your next book is called California Eccentrics, Fruits, Flakes, and Nuts. Well, we've certainly had plenty of those over the years.
Yeah, and it's turning out to be a fairly easy book to write. I have to even draw the line saying, is this guy really a fruit freak or a nut, or is he just a beautiful loser? You know, it's like, I'm picking out the fruits, flakes, and nuts.
When's that going to come out?
That'll be out next year, fall on 2011. Same Craven Street Books again.
Do you happen to know what time of day Deadly Women airs on the Investigation Discovery Channel?
It's being shown all over the world at the same time. And in California and the Pacific time, it's going to be on at 10 o'clock p.m.
So it's shown around the world at the same time?
Yeah.
My goodness.
That's what their website says. It's
David Kolchek, international superstar.
Aw.
David Kolchek, seriously though, author of Death in California, The Bizarre, Freakish, and Just Curious Ways People Die in the Golden State. And a chapter of the book, The Duchess, is on Deadly Women this Thursday. David, welcome back to Insight, and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, you'll meet the Sacramento chef, who's a finalist on the next Food Network Star YouTube Challenge. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. And if you missed any of our shows, don't worry about it. You can go to our website, download at your pleasure, capradio.org/insight. A chef from Sacramento is a finalist in the next Food Network Stars YouTube Challenge. Today's the last day of voting. Ryan Rose joins us. Ryan, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jeffrey. It's great to be here.
This YouTube challenge is obviously related to the next Food Network Star TV show, but it's not the same thing because the next Food Network Star actually had its finale last night. What's the difference between that and the YouTube challenge?
Well, basically, it's a YouTube challenge that they had on their webpage. And I was actually found out about it looking for the casting call for the next season of the next Food Network Star.
Because you would like to be on the actual TV
Absolutely.
Show.
Absolutely. I would like to be there, yeah. So So I clicked on their link, and it was a challenge that they had on YouTube. And I think it kind of basically followed the same rules of how you get onto the casting call of the regular show. So anyways, we sent in the video, and next thing you know, found out that I was one of the top 15 finalists.
Well, congratulations on that.
Thanks.
How did you set about making the video?
You know, actually, one of the servers at our restaurant, he knows how to tape. So I asked him to bring the camera in one day, and it worked out really well because in the video I made a paella, and Spain was playing in the World Cup that day. So, you know, we got in there early in the morning and kind of started messing around and made the tape and then brought it out into the dining room when there was a huge crowd of people out there ready to eat.
My guest is Ryan Rose. He's a chef at the Zocalo restaurant in Midtown Sacramento, and he's one of the finalists in the next Food Network Star YouTube Challenge. Let's listen to a clip of the video that he submitted. Obviously, you're not experiencing the whole thing because you're not seeing the visual component, which is an important part of it. And it was recorded not with professional equipment. Having said that, here's Ryan in the kitchen.
Now, all I'm going to do here is just do some mussels and some shrimp. The shrimp are going to take about 4 to 5 minutes, as well as the mussels. Everything's going to open up. The shrimp are going to start turning opaque, and they're basically saying, I'm ready, do not cook me any longer. On my side here, I have a little bit of red bell pepper that I'm sauteing for presentation. I'm going in with that as well. We're at the finish line, guys. The shrimp has turned its color, mussels are open, rice is at the texture that we want, chicken's all the way cooked through. The last few stages are very simple.
Well, what are those last simple stages of the paella?
You know what? I've watched that video probably about a million times, so I could tell you every single one. What I did was I took a few Mexican ingredients, because that's what we cook, obviously, at Zocalo, and in making a Spanish dish. So I wanted to infuse a little bit of Mexican flavor. So one of the main last ingredients was a little bit of cilantro to give that nice fresh flavor. And then ended up the paella with lemon juice. And in the tape, what I say is that the acid of the lemon, you obviously want the flavor of the lemon, but the acid of the lemon helps really bring all the flavors and really heightens them.
I've watched the video a couple of times, and I get hungry just watching it because the paella looks awesome. Is that something you actually make to serve in the restaurant?
I tell you, we have a dish on our menu right now for the summer, and it's called arroz a la tumbada. And it's a dish that comes from Veracruz, the state of Veracruz in Mexico. And that's actually where Spain made their way into Mexico back in the 1500s. So the idea of paella is definitely in that dish.
The video is shot in the actual kitchen at Zocalo,
right,
when people are actually working.
Definitely.
So it looks crazy. why didn't you do it at 2 o'clock in the morning so you had complete control over the surroundings?
Well, you know, to tell you the truth, I wanted to be different. I wanted the video to be different. It needed to stick out. There was 250 submissions, and I thought there would be more like 1,000, you know, coming from the Food Network. But every single other video was basically shot in someone's home. Very quiet, nothing really going on. It was just the person, you know, going through the steps of their dishes. I wanted to stick out, and I wanted there to be a little bit more excitement, and I wanted there to be flames, and I think that we captured that in the video.
Well, all of that certainly is in the video, and the thing that really impressed me was the way you were able to cook this with a huge frying pan, and you're talking to the camera, and you're giving us information about the dish. Basically, it's everything that on the program, which I watch, the next Food Network star, it's everything that they ask of the people on the show, and half of them can't do.
Yeah.
So when I was watching you, I was thinking, man, you're doing what a lot of the people in the TV show can't seem to do.
Well, I appreciate that. And, you know, I've been watching Food Network for years now. And really, you know, out of college, I didn't go to culinary school. And my culinary school was Emeril Lagasse cooking on, you know, on the Food Network. And, you know, after years of watching his show and many others, you kind of see that there's a outlying thing that each cook does in their show. And that's usually, you know, talking about the dish while they're cooking, looking at the camera, telling stories, and that's what I try to do in the video.
But it's not what you usually do when you're actually cooking in the Zocalo kitchen.
Actually, usually I'm speaking Spanish when I'm in the Zocalo kitchen, so and there's a lot more yelling going on, but there's definitely no camera running around.
And you're not explaining the food?
No, not whatsoever.
Yeah. Did the next Food Network star say what they were looking for, or do they just say, if you think you're good enough, make the video and send it to us?
That's exactly what they're doing, and, you know, they have the new casting call going on, which is going to be ends in October. Hopefully I make I win this one, which again, the last day to vote is today. But, if not, you know, I send in another video and, learn from what I did this last one and try to go on the casting call for their next show.
So you plan to go on the casting call for the next show, but what happens? Let's say you win the YouTube challenge. What happens? What do you get?
You know what? What they promise you on the deal is that they fly you down to New York where their home studio is. And I've actually had the chance of being there. It's an incredible place, Chelsea Market. But you really just get an audition with their executive producers. You know, they don't tell you that you get a show. And to tell you the truth, I don't even know if the audition is for a show of your own or if it's to become one of the finalists for the next season of the next Food Network star. I'm not quite sure on that. It didn't really get too much into explications there.
Did you watch the latest season of the next Food Network star?
Absolutely, and I was excited to see who won. It was a great ending.
Yeah, Aarti won, this sort of really charming woman.
Right.
Seems to be from India but lives in the United States. So
right.
you were rooting for Aarti.
I was. I you know, the last three that they had on there were all great. Big Chef, he was calling himself Tom. He would have been fun to watch. But Artie, she knew how to talk to the camera incredibly well.
Well, one thing the judges on the next Food Network Star are always saying to the contestants is, what is your show? What is your angle? What would be your show if you were on the Food Network Star?
Well, definitely Mexican food would definitely be it. And our logo at Zocalo is a taste of Mexico, and that, I think that would be a great name for a show, you know. Maybe the greatest thing would be to travel Mexico. Maybe you're in a marketplace in Oaxaca, or you're at a quinceañera, maybe at someone's house, and you're watching how people are reacting with food, and then you bring it back home and show how someone here can make it.
My guest is Ryan Rose, chef at the Zocalo restaurant in Midtown Sacramento, and one of the finalists in the next Food Network Star YouTube Challenge. Today's the last day of voting. You say in the video that you shot for the YouTube Challenge that you learned how to cook the paella while you were studying in Spain. What were you doing in Spain?
I was actually studying Spanish. So I grew up in a small town of Clarksburg, which is off the Sacramento River, and I was always involved and around Mexican heritage and Mexican culture, and it's something that I've always been fascinated with. I knew I wanted to study Spanish, and that's what I did. I was there for 2 years in Granada, Spain. I had to find my own place to live over there, and I did, and my roommate was this Italian guy, and he lived with his grandma in Italy. He knew how to cook, and honestly, I mean, I would watch him every single day and take notes, and then kind of walk throughout the streets in Granada and see people cooking and things like that. And then when I came home, I knew that's what I wanted to do.
And you've worked your way up at Zocalo. I thought it was from bartender, but you were actually not even the bartender when you started.
No, I was a bar back. That's the helper of a bartender. And it was a month after Zocalo opened, which is now getting close to 6 months. Actually, this weekend, on this coming Saturday, we're having our six-year anniversary, which we're really excited about. So come check us out. But so I started as a bar back, and you know, it was right after college, so I had to go tell Mom, hey, guess what? My first job after college is a bar back. But it was the only way I could get into a restaurant, something I knew I wanted to do without having any type of experience.
And what are you now at Zocalo?
I'm now the head chef. So, I work my way up through the ranks up in the front, which has been great because I've really learned how to serve people, and that's really what we pride ourselves on.
But so you know every part of the job.
Yeah, bartender, I served. I was a front of the house manager, and now I'm in the back.
And you hope to be on the Food Network, but if that doesn't work out, what are your plans? To have your own restaurant?
Definitely. Right now we're really just focusing on making Zocalo a great restaurant here in Sacramento, and we pride ourselves on what we're doing, and we're already looking into new ideas for our next menu. So if this doesn't work out, again, I send in a new video for their October casting, and other than that, it's business back at Zocalo in the kitchen.
Well, good luck, Ryan.
Thank you very much, and I really appreciate you having me.
Well, as I said, today's the last day of voting for Ryan Rose. It's easy to find on YouTube. There's a Next Food Network Star channel there. You can see Ryan and other videos, but I have to say Ryan's video is pretty cool. Ryan is head chef at the Zocalo restaurant in Midtown Sacramento. Ryan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And that's Insight for today. Today's associate producers, Lynn Weaver, Natalie Rothfels, and Sosin Morar. Production assistance today also from Ben Adler. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. And thank you for joining us. As schools start up again, local health officials say young people should get vaccinated against meningitis because death rates are up to 5 times higher for kids, teens, and young adults. You'll hear from a Sacramento woman who lost her daughter in just hours to the infection that hits the brain and spinal cord. Also, a new technique to diagnose oral cancer from UC Davis researchers. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.